You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Here we go. The name Bacardi is synonymous with two things, an internationally popular brand of rum, the family business, and the family's historic links to Cuba over five generations. Ever since the island's fight for independence from Spain in the 1860s, there's been no chapter of its history in which the Bacardis have not played a part. Here to tell us more is NPR's Tom Gelton. His latest book is called Bacardi and the Long Fight for Cuba, the biography of a cause. It's published by Viking, and I'm very pleased to welcome him back to the show. Hi.
Hi, Leonard.
Did you decide to write about Cuba first or the Bacardis?
Cuba first. I came back from 10 years in Eastern Europe where I'd reported on the collapse of communism and the transition to democracy, and previous to that I'd been the Latin America correspondent. I spoke Spanish, and I came back with the expectation that the same thing that had happened in Eastern Europe was about to happen in Cuba. A lot of people had that idea, and I started going regularly to Cuba in the 1994, I think, and I just got fascinated by that story. As a journalist, I think any time that you have a story that is unpredictable, that is confusing, that is mysterious and suspenseful, you know, it just grabbed me. I felt every time I came back from Cuba, Leonard, I felt like I didn't understand it as well as I had the previous time. So I'm sort of going downhill in my understanding of Cuba. There's so many layers to the Cuban experience, the Cuban historical experience, the Cuban social experience politically. And I just really wanted to dig.
And this gave you a window into it?
Of the things that I wanted to get into was history. I wanted to take a really long view of the whole Cuba story and sort of start from scratch. And along the way, I sort of bumped into this Bacardi story, and I thought, here's a set of characters, here's a narrative in which, you know, I can tell the whole Cuba story around this family.
But since there are areas of disagreement, how hard or easy was this to research? Was the Bacardi family helpful? Was the Cuban government willing to talk?
I tell people that in doing a story about Bacardi, a book about Bacardi in Cuba, I took probably two of the most difficult partners I could have chosen in research. The Cuban government, the Bacardi Corporation is a family-held corporation, and basically their default position for years and years and years has just been they don't talk to anybody. They just don't. And they don't care what you write about them. You know, you can write terrible things about them. They're just not going to talk. So,
is this because of the part of the story we'll get to later, their whole complicated relationship with Fidel Castro?
It goes back beyond that. It's a family-owned company, and you know, they just have been secretive for a long time. And then once they got into the exile period when Cuba became such a controversial issue, they just didn't want to talk about it. And, you know, the Cuban government, as you can well imagine, is very suspicious about people writing books because they don't ever know where you're going to go with something. You have to go there. I mean, I've been working on this for years, and I've been going there many times, and they're not, you know, they can't be sure what you're going to do. So, yeah, it wasn't easy. But I found enough friendly people on both sides that I was able to sort of move steadily ahead.
Well, let's go back to the beginning. Don Facundo Bacardi. Mm-hmm. He's from Spain.
Don Facundo is a Spanish immigrant. He's from the Catalonia region. He's a merchant, like many Catalan immigrants in Santiago de Cuba. He comes over, just to tell that story briefly. He goes into the grocery business with his brothers, but he's got big ambitions. He wants to be a rich businessman, and he's looking for casting around years trying to find out what it is that he can do that's really really strike it rich. And he comes up with this idea of making rum.
And at that time, you say rum was considered to be a rough drink, one not usually sold to the higher end
consumer.
And he found a way to change that?
Well, his genius was in seeing that rum could potentially appeal to a much wider market. It appealed, as you say, to a smaller market. And he figured if he could make a rum that would be that women would like, that sort of high-class people that would like, that could be mixed with other things.
Before Coca-Cola had been invented.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, I would say. I don't know when Coca-Cola was invented.
I think so.
But this is, yeah, we're talking the middle of the 19th century. The other thing is that he had the raw ingredients. Cuba is just awash in molasses. You know, and a lot of the molasses had been shipped out of the country to make rum in New England, for example. So, know, why not focus on that?
Well, that rum trade, the molasses, all of that was tied in with the slave trade.
It was indeed.
So was he implicated in the slave trade?
No, because he was just buying molasses from the sugar producers. I mean, it was a very small company for years and years and years. Just a small, it was a family company, just had a few dozen employees at the most, and they bought molasses from the surrounding sugar plantations and ran this distillery. No, in fact, you know, we're the next part of the story is the whole political side of the Bacardi.
Emilio,
narrative.
His son.
Yeah. Emilio, his son, who after there was an earthquake in Santiago and the Bacardi family temporarily moved back to Spain and then immediately returned to Santiago. But Emilio stayed in Spain as a young man and was educated there in his early years. And when he came back to Cuba, he came back sort of all fired up politically and was a fierce opponent of slavery. And that was a very big issue in the middle of the 19th century in Cuba.
Did that gain the Bacardis respect? Because there were there was a large black population, although it was an oppressed population.
Well, the big issue in Cuba in the 19th century was the struggle for independence from Spain. And Cuba was indeed a majority black country. And so independence from Spain would necessarily mean the rebel army, the army that fought the Spanish army for independence was a largely black army. And the commanding general was Antonio Maceo, who was black. So the fight for racial equality in Cuba and the fight for independence were very intertwined. And the Bacardis as a family, Emilio in particular, was deeply involved as an underground conspirator in the revolutionary movements for independence. And that necessarily meant also fighting to end slavery.
And who was minding the store while he was off fighting?
His brother, Facundo Jr., Emilio was actually never, he was a very popular figure. He's a fascinating guy. He, Renaissance man, he spoke different languages, wrote novels, wrote poetry, wrote plays, deeply involved in politics. A very popular guy. He never was actually much of a rum drinker, and he never really paid attention to the rum business. His brother, Facundo Jr., was the quiet guy that really mastered the art of rum blending.
Another interesting character is Enrique Schug. Mm-hmm. Now, this Schug, S-C-H-U-E,
Schweig. Yeah.
Well, that does not sound like a Hispanic name.
He's French. He's French. His parents were French. There were a lot of in Eastern
Sounds
Cuba.
Alsatian, in fact.
Well, I don't know the origins.
Because it's kind of German.
But what happened, Leonard, is there was a revolution next door in Haiti in the last part of the last decade of the 18th century, 1791. And a lot of the French colonists, Haiti was a French colony, and a lot of the French colonists moved at that point from Haiti to Eastern Cuba. So there were a lot of French. In fact, Don Facundo's wife was a French Cuban. Emilio's wife was a French Cuban. Enrique Schweig, his original name was Henri Schweig, and living in Cuba, he changed it to Enrique, but he was French. So there were a lot of French people there.
Bacardi also got into the beer business, and Ernest Hemingway comes into the story because of that.
Well, Enrique Schweig, who was a brilliant businessman, you had these two brothers, Emilio and Facundo Jr., and their brother-in-law, Enrique, who married Emilio and Facundo's sister. They were very complimentary. Facundo was the rum expert. Emilio was the politician and public relations guy. And Enrique was the business guy. And he recognized two things. One, that Bacardi needed to export, needed to make its rum known all over the world. And he really pushed the export market. The other thing he did in the 1920s is he said, there's an opening here for beer. There were a lot of the beer operations in Cuba at that time were foreign run. He says, we can make beer. And they got into the Hatue brand. They developed that. There's an interesting story about how they came up with the name Hatue. He's a Indian resistance hero from the independence fight.
And Hemingway readers will recognize the name.
Hatue beer over the years became the most famous Cuban beer, and Ernest Hemingway lived in Cuba for many years, and he talks in his novels about Hatue beer.
My guest is Tom Gelton, whose latest book is Bacardi and the Long Fight for Cuba. It is published by Viking. We talked about export in America. The United States was a major market, and then came Prohibition.
Right. And actually, Bacardi is one of those products that flourished in Prohibition. And this is a complicated thing. I don't know whether it's the forbidden fruit or what phenomenon it is. But Cuba was so close to the United States that what American tourists, at least those with some money, did was that they would go to Cuba. There was a famous ad in those days showed Uncle Sam flying on a Bacardi bat from dry Florida to wet Cuba. So tourists flocked to Cuba in the 20s and 30s to get to drink, to party. And Bacardi rum was there. That's when Bacardi rum really became famous to Americans.
And there were rum runners who were bringing Bacardi into the United States, exactly, even though it was illegal. Mm-hmm. You mentioned that bat. Why is there a bat on the label of Bacardi products?
I don't know the answer to that, because there are different versions of that story. There's sort of a prosaic explanation and a more romantic one. The romantic one is that when they opened the first distillery, which was a kind of a ramshackle building, there was a colony of fruit bats living in the rafters, and the wife of Don Facundo suggested that they make the bat their logo. That's a nice, colorful story. I've also heard that in the beginning, when Bacardi rum was first made, they didn't bottle it. They just sold it in whatever containers were lying around. And they recycled containers. Some people would bring their own containers. And the Bacardi brothers had a grocery store where they sold olive oil from Italy that came in big 5-gallon tins that had a symbol of a bat. This olive oil company in Italy used the bat as its symbol. And they recycled those tins with rum. And people began asking for the rum of the bat. And that's another possibility of how the bat symbol. But one thing to understand is that in those days, in Cuba and in Spain, the bat was not seen as this creepy kind of symbol. It was seen actually very tenderly.
How did they get along with the Batista government?
Well, so the Bacardis have this long, patriotic, progressive profile in Cuba. And another in-law, the guy who married the granddaughter of the founder, Pepin Bosch, became very, just as Emilio and others had in previous years, he was first of all involved in the fight against Machado, who was the dictator who preceded Batista, and then he was deeply involved in the fight against Batista. And interestingly enough, Leonard, he was so prominent in the anti-Batista movement that he worried that Batista was going to expropriate the Bacardi Rum Company. So in the 1950s, if we jump ahead to that decade, Pepin Bosch moved the Bacardi trademarks, and decentralized some of the operations outside Cuba to get it out of the reach of Batista.
Well, there were other reasons. He went to the Bahamas and he went to Puerto Rico. He goes to the Bahamas, and that gives him a lot of access to the British Commonwealth. And opens up the trade there. He goes to Puerto Rico, and that really makes it a lot easier to come to the United States. I don't know what the Cubans thought of all of this, but they were decentralizing, and it was a very prescient move, because even though they were supporters of Castro, in fact, I read that Juan Pepin Bosch and Daniel Bacardi were sent to the United States as a trade commission, part of a trade delegation.
Here's the story on that. Pepin Bosch, who was the chairman of the Bacardi Rum Company, in April of 1959, Fidel makes his one and only trip to Washington as a new president. He takes one Cuban businessman with him, Pepin Bosch. Daniel actually didn't go on that trip. But at that point, Pepin Bosch is the Cuban businessman most closely associated with Fidel Castro, and he is Fidel Castro's favorite Cuban businessman. He also donated tens of thousands of dollars of his own money, as did other members of the Bacardi family, to purchase weapons for Castro's rebels fighting in the mountains. And when American newspaper reporters were covering the rise of Fidel Castro, there was only one Cuban guy, prominent Cuban business leader, who would go on the record saying, "We got to get rid of Batista. Fidel Castro's a good guy." So they'd go to Pepin Bosch for a quote.
So they must have felt terribly betrayed when Castro came to power and he nationalized the company.
You know, I went back, Leonard, a couple of years ago, and I tracked down the vice minister of industry in 1960 when the company was nationalized. And I said, "So why did you guys nationalize Bacardi?" Because I had, at this point, done a lot of research and I knew their whole progressive past. And he said, "It was nothing personal against the Bacardis. Actually, they were a great patriotic Cuban company. We just made a decision at that point to go for socialism." And all Cuban firms had to go.
Were the Bacardis, had they been given any warning? Because they had already kind of moved out. A lot of the operation had also gone to Florida, hadn't
they? They went to Puerto Rico in the 30s, as you say, to get entry to that market. They'd established operations in Mexico at that point. None of this was as a result of any concern about Fidel Castro. It was for its own sort of commercial reasons. Daniel Bacardi, who you mentioned earlier, was the head of the company in Santiago. He was basically a supporter of the revolution, believed in the revolution until a week before it was confiscated.
So they all moved into exile, into Miami with other Cuban exiles, into a very conservative community there. Did they get involved in community politics, in U.S. politics?
I think, you said before they must have felt betrayed. One of the things that I've noticed is a lot of the Cuban business families who were supporters of Batista, when they went into exile, they didn't get involved in counter-revolutionary stuff. And the Bacardis, on the other hand, did. And I think it's precisely because they were so angry. They did feel betrayed, that sort of energized them. And Pepin Bosch, who we've been talking about, became as big an enemy of Fidel Castro during exile as he had been an ally of Fidel before that.
One of the leaders of the anti-Castro group is named Bosch. I don't know if he's related.
There's Orlando Bosch,
yeah,
who's a terrorist. No, there's no relation there. Pepin Bosch actually did get involved in some sabotage activities, but not to that extent.
The Bacardis have maintained that very close identification with Cuba, despite the fact that they're not there. Has this upset the Cuban government at all?
I spoke
because Cuba is producing its own rum.
It is. I talked to Ricardo Alarcón, who's the number three guy in Cuba, and he told me the Bacardis are the centerpiece of the Cuban counter-revolution abroad. So they have been associated politically with efforts to tighten the embargo and so forth. The interesting thing, though, is in their hometown of Santiago, where Emilio was the first mayor. The first Cuban mayor, and where there's still a lot of the old Bacardi factories there. There's a Bacardi museum. In Santiago, the Bacardi family is still seen very affectionately.
Do you think there's any possibility, considering the fact that they have been so strong in opposition, that now that we're going through some kind of political change and it's likely that private industry will be allowed again in Cuba, that the Bacardis will be allowed to return?
Well, one of the reasons, as we said at the beginning, one of the reasons I chose the Bacardi story to write about Cuba is that whether you're talking about the past, the present, and even the future, there's some little Bacardi angle. And, Cuban rum is one of the few real bright spots. The Cuban rum industry is one of the few bright spots in the Cuban economy. And I think it's entirely possible that the Bacardis will go back, and they are thinking about it at some point, and sort of get back into rum making in Cuba.
Considering how famous internationally the Bacardi name is and how much the sugar industry in Cuba is struggling, I would think that it would be in the best interest of the government no matter what has happened in the past.
Well, there could very well be a deal that is struck. I mean, the Cuban government has its own brand now, Havana Club Rum, and Bacardi and Pernod Ricard, which is the big French company that's in a joint venture to distribute Havana Club Rum around the world, have been locked for the last several years. And I devote a whole chapter to this in a very bitter dispute, commercial dispute. And I think that that dispute would have to be resolved before, any cooperative agreement can be worked out. But some people are predicting that it will be.
Well, you've devoted a lot of time to writing this book. Do you have another project in the works?
I'm paying attention to Cuba right now because Cuba is, it's in this very unpredictable kind of mysterious state. So I'm going to continue to follow Cuba. I don't think my next book is going to be about Cuba, but I don't know how long it'll be. Remember, it's been like 10 years since I last wrote a book. So,
Well, Raul is not a kid anymore.
He's 76, I think. Now.
So who do you think is next in line? Is it a parent?
No. No, and we don't even know what's going on with Fidel, whether he's, incapacitated or able to make some recovery at some point. I don't know. The only thing that I know, Leonard, about Cuba and that I feel with any confidence is that there's a whole new sort of management class, kind of like the nomenclatura that you saw in Eastern Europe, younger Cubans who have now had over the last 10 or 20 years a lot of experience dealing with foreign corporations, a kind of a technocrat class. I think we're going to see them sort of emerge in the coming years as being very important.
My great thanks to Tom Gelton of NPR and PBS fame for talking with us about his latest book, Bacardi and the Long Fight for Cuba. It is published by Viking. Thank you so much.
Good to see you again, Leonard.